Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
The McNeil and Parkins Show.
670 The Score in Chicago. Shout out to you guys, McNeil and Parkins. Love you guys.
Afternoons on The Score.
And now, the starting lineup for your world champion Chicago Bulls. A 6'2 guard from Iowa, DJ Armstrong.
Armstrong for three. Oh, they are on fire from downtown.
DJ Armstrong. Pretty feed to DJ Armstrong. Armstrong, sweet shot.
That's what he's done better.
It's a three-on-one. Armstrong for Pippen. Armstrong on the run. Chambers getting back. The lead for Pippen. Bulls not rushing their shots again, showing the patience. Now Armstrong is open for the three-pointer. And hits it.
Chicago swings it, finds the best three-point shooter in the league. B.J. Armstrong knocks it down.
Marv showing the patience of a championship team.
The Chicago Bulls have three straight championships.
The next guy I want to bring up, in his first day of practice at the old multiplex, they weren't going to let him in because they thought he was too young. They call him the kid, but he's a man. B.J. Armstrong.
And Johnson went down in a collision with Armstrong.
No collision, Marv. B.J. pushed him down. There's a little thing going on here.
B.J. felt that him holding off was a little too hard. He shoved him in the head. There's the push to the ground. That's no accident.
Thanks. God bless all of you. I hope we'll be back here again next year. Thank you.
The McNeil and Parkins Show. Afternoons on The Score.
Beautifully done, Chris Tannehill. Welcome back in. McNeil and Parkins on The Score. We debuted this during the coronavirus lockdown. We're calling these their Scorentine shows here on The Score. Score stories. We bring on a guest just to tell some stories, catch up with them, hopefully put a smile on your face. Who better than a three-time champion to tell some 90s Bulls stories than B.J. Armstrong, who's kind enough to join us now on the Al Pamonte Ford Hotline. B.J., thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I was just listening to the intro. It's you know, I forgot about all that, and that was great. I was fun. I was just listening.
What memory in particular did it jog for you there?
Well, you just remember all of the journeys and things you were thinking during that particular time. So, just really fortunate to be around, you know, some great people, to hear the late Johnny Redkerr's call and. And all those times and all those things that we all went through together, we were all so young and everyone was just trying to make a name for themselves and trying to fit in and do their part. And you never know how things are going to come out. But we had a great group of guys, great coaches, you know, great staff. And, you know, we did a lot of special things together up there.
You guys won a championship, I think, BJ, in your second year in the league only, and then that would mean year three and year four as well. Did you, as a young player at the time, do you remember being mindful enough of how fortunate you were to be right place at the right time? Did you get that as a young guy?
Yeah, you know what? The one thing about getting to the NBA, it's a very humbling experience because you begin to realize how difficult it really is to win, let alone win a championship. You know, just to win a game because, you know, you can't get too high and you can't get too low. So the competition, the level and the understanding of how difficult and the task at hand, you know, in that time, in that era, I mean, we were playing against some great teams, the Detroit Pistons and you know, the Lakers and so forth and so on. There were just so many great teams, great players. So I remember being very mindful of having this opportunity and not wanting to let it squander, because you're at a place where you didn't know if you're ever going to get back there, let alone win three championships. And in the case, you know, the Bulls were able to win six championships in the 90s alone. So it was a great time, great learning experience. But yeah, I was very mindful that, you know what, you want to take advantage of this opportunity.
What was the process like of you guys coming together as a team? Because from the outside looking in, you know, you've got Scotty and Horace, who are rural guys. Michael kind of grows up middle class. He's the prodigy. You're from Detroit. Right. Phil Jackson is, you know, Phil Jackson. What were the challenges of all of those different types of backgrounds coming together?
Well, I think one of the things that really helped me as a young player when I came in was having veterans like Bill Cartwright on the team, having veterans like John Paxson, having veterans like Craig Hodges and Ed Neely and those type of guys. Those were to me, the pillars that allowed me to understand not what I needed to do on the court, but what I needed to do off the court as a young player. So those pros and those veterans, they really helped me to transition to become a pro, to let me know that, you know what, you know, you're young right now, but at some point you're going to be me, and I need you to understand and play your part in this role, because it's taken me a long time to get here talking about the veteran guys and all of us young guys, Scotty, Horace, all of us were young guys saying, hey, we have the rest of our career ahead of us, but before you know it, you'll be a 10, 11-year vet. And those guys kind of gave me the sense of urgency, and in particular, Bill Cartwright, his leadership in the locker room, and he allowed us to self-police ourselves, if you will. And I can't, you know, I just spoke to him the other day. I always check in with Bill from time to time because he was a pro's pro. And he was kind of the glue of the team. You know, that's why we gave him the nickname as the teacher. And it was a reason, because he always thought about the group. He was always thinking about the team. But more importantly, he had the respect of the old guys, the young guys, the coaches. And he was a great locker room leader for our group, and helped us to understand and play with that urgency that we needed.
PJ, I want to ask you about one of those guys in particular you mentioned, and the greatness of Jordan and Pippen. I mean, that's known globally, but yes. I think of all the Bulls I've watched over the years, and I'll be 59 this summer, I don't know if there's anybody I admired more than Horace in terms of how much better he made himself and his work with Al Vermeil in the weight room. He was just a skinny, bashful kid when he got here, and he was one of the best big defenders in the league 5 years into it.
Yeah, Horace always had a work ethic. And, you know, Horace was a – you know, you have guys, and you talk about good teammates. Horace was a great teammate because he was the ultimate role player. You know, we all come in this league, we're all trying to find out who we are, what we're going to be in this league. And Horace very quickly understood who he could be. He was a defender. He was a rebounder. And, you know, now looking back on it, Horace was really a positionless player in many regards, because he could switch and guard a Vinnie Johnson. He could guard, you know, guys on the post. He could, you know, he could do a lot of things. And then once he put that little, you know, free throw line jump shot into his game, he was a hard player to defend because you couldn't leave him. So he just really figured out who he was and what he could do, and he played his role, and he was able to win championships. I think he won another one in Los Angeles with the Lakers and had a great run down there in Orlando, and he's a great teammate. So I see Horace from time to time, and he's still Horace, he's still funny, and, you know, he had a phenomenal career.
We're telling stories with B.J. Armstrong here, McNeil and Parkins on the Score. You know, you've given out the label of good teammate a couple of times. Would you describe Michael Jordan as a good teammate?
You know, Michael, he was good in his own sense. He was so unique because he was a star. You know, he was a star of stars. And, you know, the one thing that I think, you know, that I always remember and I always respected about him is how he respected the fact that, you know, he never imposed his superstardom or who he was as a player. He made sure that he was one of the guys, and he always made sure that when we were on the bus, we played cards. When we were on the plane, we played cards. Whenever there was a time to just hang out with the guys and we could just hang out, he was just one of the guys. So I think he had a better understanding of that before we did, because he always just remained one of the guys. You know, he was Air Jordan, everyone else, but he was just, you know, he was just M, you know, as we called him to us. And he made that very clear that he was one of the guys. He was in for it, and his leadership and things he was able to do. So he was a very unique individual, and had a great understanding and awareness of what he meant to the team, what the team meant to him. And once he figured that out on the court and off of it, it was history.
All right, BJ, so take us inside that card game. What games are we playing? What are the stakes?
Well, I mean, we play all types of games, but I think the funnest game that we would play is we would always, you know, we play blackjack, and the whole team would always play against Michael. You know, he was kind of the house. I always remember that was like everyone on the team was trying to beat him. You know, that was one of the great things that, you know, we would play hard. We would do our thing, but the competitive spirit was always there on everywhere we went, right? So as soon as we got on the plane, you know, we were there. And it was always the team versus him. And he was the house, and we would always make the rookies shuffle the cards, and we would just play. And we just play for hours. I just remember we wouldn't eat. We wouldn't do anything. We would just play, and everyone was just trying to break the house. And looking back on it, you couldn't break the house, but it was fun trying to do it.
What were the stakes?
Oh, well, the stakes got pretty, you know, they would get pretty high depending on the game. But, you know, we had a lot of fun, a lot of trash talking. But most importantly, I think it was a bonding experience for all of us because everyone participated. You know, it was like one of those things that, you know, you played and the games were always better when you won. So we had like this, we were in our groove as I think about it. And we had a good flow, a good group of guys that all got along.
It was well known Phil Jackson took up the practice of giving everybody a book every now and again. Did he ever give you one that resonated with you, and what was it?
I can't remember. He did give us books. He did, and I can't remember the books that he gave me. But I mean, he would give us books. And back then, you know, when I first came in the league, in those times, we were traveling commercial. So I would take my book along, and I remember I would read it, and him and I, we would discuss, you know, from time to time things, but I can't remember, it's been so long now, books, but he definitely would give us books and wanted to keep our minds, you know, kind of, you know, occupied and doing other things and be aware of our surroundings around us. So, you know, that was always good.
Did you guys think Phil was a little crazy?
You know, I didn't. I personally didn't. I got him, right? And what I got was we're all in this high-pressure, high-demand type of situation where everyone was looking to perform and everyone was expected to perform. But I think Phil, you know, really had a sense of self. I think Phil had a way of dealing with the problems of the, you know, just the mundane every day that you had to do. You had to go to practice, you played in the games, and, you know, as you get into that routine, and Phil had a way of breaking it up. I mean, I could vividly remember we're in the playoffs versus the Knicks, and we're going to practice. I think we were down 0-1 or 0-2 or something in the series, and whereas we're going to practice, we go take a trip, and we go to the Statue of Liberty. And he would do things like that just to break up the routine so that we can stay engaged mentally. And I think he had an understanding about mentally making sure that, you know, that he recognizes you. So I think really he just understood, you know, people more than anything. And I think that's part of being a coach is understanding people. People come from different places all around the world, and they have different ways of viewing the world. But in the end, if we can find a common denominator, I think we can share in this experience and at least reach our potential, and I think that's what he understood.
We talk with Will Perdue fairly regularly, BJ, and he's expressed some disappointment over He said in the 90s, it was the same every summer. You guys hung around the northern suburbs. You worked out together. You played together. It can't be mandated by the team. But he said, that thing's history. That doesn't happen anymore. Why do you suppose there was a change in terms of the way, I don't know if it's just here in Chicago, but NBA players around the country, why there isn't more team in the summer? It would seem to me it'd be kind of an obvious.
Well, I mean, as you know, being an agent and doing what I'm currently doing now, it seems fairly obvious to me why, you know, that doesn't occur. Well, the main reason that doesn't occur is because when, just take myself, Will Perdue, myself, Horace, we all went to school for four years, and when we came out into the NBA, there wasn't a time where you said, you know what, BJ has 2 or 3 years to develop. BJ had to perform, or else he was going to be traded or moved or cut or what have you. So now when these players, these kids come into the league now, they're like 19 years of age, you know, we have a 3-4 year window now where we're saying, hey, he's developing. So the developmental phase of trying to get them to work with an understanding to perform is a lot different. And, you know, you got to allow these young people to figure out who they are, what they're going to be as they go about this league and as they come into the league. So the developmental era is a lot different than the era that, you know, that I played in or Will played in that era. So I think it makes sense for these guys to go out. They had to get work in the gym. They have to figure out who they're going to be. Are they going to be scorers? Are they going to be defensive players? Are they going to be, you know, distributors, what have you? And then once they can figure that out, they can go about being a pro and figuring out how they can actually contribute to winning, which is the bottom line in this business.
We're talking to BJ Armstrong, 3-time NBA champion with the Bulls here, McNeil and Parkins on the Score. You mentioned that you're an agent now. What are you telling your clients during the NBA being locked down and what's next for them with the coronavirus concerns?
Stay home. You know, that's the main message here is really be responsible and be accountable to playing our part in this, you know, what we have going on here, right? Everyone is affected by this, whether you are an NBA player or, you know, whomever, everyone is affected. So just being responsible, holding yourself accountable or doing what you have to do to play your part in this global community. Because right now we're all, you know, we have to all work as one. And if anything, you know, we have to play our part on this team. So it's going to take us all to be committed to one goal here. And then one goal is to fight this, and we got to fight this one together.
Are you experiencing compliance from your clientele?
Yeah, I think we are because, you know, it's been interesting because not only do I have clients here that play in the NBA, I have clients abroad. So, you know, it's been interesting to see the responses of different countries, different leagues, how players are figuring out how to get home, get back to their loved ones, and also being responsible, right? You know, certain regions or certain areas of the world are more affected than others, but we're all aware of what we have to do and not exposing others and our loved ones and people that we care about. So it's been interesting. It's been just like everyone else. It's been, you know, we're just trying to get the information, trying to get the clarity that we want so that we can return back to our everyday lives as quickly as we can.
Do you think an NBA champion is going to be crowned this year?
That's interesting. You know, in talking to owners and, you know, executives around the league, I mean, I don't know. I know everyone would love to play. I know everyone would love to compete and get back and get back to, you know, their everyday routine. But I really don't know at this particular time. I think the league, I think Adam Silver has come out and said, we're going to do everything we possibly can. But, you know, what that means and health concerns and concerns of all, you know, I think is something that we're all trying to figure out on a day-to-day basis.
All right, back to the stories for just a minute. I wanted to ask you about a particular set of time here. We got a couple more minutes with BJ Armstrong.
Sure.
So Jordan retires, right, and he's going and playing baseball. And then you're an all-star in 94. You're one of the main benefactors of that extra playing time, the extra scoring, and all of that. But I've read that while he's playing baseball, he's calling you to find out stuff about the team. Like, can you talk about your correspondence with Mike while you're playing and having a career year, but he's playing baseball, but still keeping tabs on you guys?
I've always tried to keep our relationship as when you're a friend, you try to be a good friend. But here it was a unique situation where he retired, right? And there was much going on about why he retired, what happened, what have you. But the one thing that when he announced who he was retiring to the team is, I just said, listen, you have two of the scary things for anyone, right? You have free time now and you have a lot of money. And a lot of money and free time normally equals problems, right? It equals trouble. And I just wanted to make sure to be a good friend. That's all I wanted to do, is be a good friend to him, just like everyone else, and to make sure that we all checked in with him from time to time, whatever he was going to do. So during this process, we would just check in, and he would check in. And I just always thought it was, strange at the time, is that he was still very detailed. I mean, that's the one thing I don't know how many people really know, but Michael was very detailed about the scouting reports and things he would do as he would prepare for the game. And he always wanted to know the scouting reports. And I thought, why does he care? But hey, if we can talk, if we can, discuss certain things, and if that's what we're going to just talk about. But he was very, very interested in what teams were going to do. Then he started asking me about need plays at the end of the games. He wanted to know, just things that, people who don't, if you're just talking basketball, you're just talking about, certain things. But he wanted to know the details of the game. He wanted to know the play calls. He wanted to know the spacing on the floor. He wanted to know all of these things that we would discuss as if we were playing. And I just thought, well, the light's never off. But I knew the light was never going to go off with him, because everyone that knows him, he's going to compete in something. And lo and behold, those conversations turned into one day he shows up and says, hey, what are you doing? Let's go to breakfast and hang out. And as to say, the rest is history, as he eventually did come back. But he was always very intrigued. And I think mentally he stayed engaged into the game, and he continued to watch the game mentally as he was, watching it from afar. But I just think that was the way he thought about it. He always knew physically he had gifts, but mentally he was able to see the game, understand the game, and then go out there and execute it, because he had a huge advantage as an athlete himself, but mentally he was just as strong or stronger than anyone else that played.
One more regarding what we're doing in the absence of a college basketball tournament, BJ. Nobody wearing black, gold, and white to root for this year. No BJ Armstrong, no AC Earl, no Wade Looking Bill. What is your favorite sports movie of all time? We threw 64 sports movies out there, and we're down to the Sweet 16 right now. What's your favorite sports movie?
Well, I would say my favorite fight is The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. I think that's the name of it. I probably had to say that one. Hoosiers, I think it's a good storyline. Probably the best one I've seen that's made as far as a storyline. The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. I think I'm going to have to go with that one.
Okay, 1979 was the release date, so that makes sense based on your age. That one's been mentioned a few times. I have only seen that once, and it's been many, many years, and it didn't make the cut. It was on the list of snubs directed by...
What's your cut? Which one did you like?
I would probably have to go with Caddyshack mine. Yeah, Hoosier's very high, too. And we had a debate the other day as to whether Norman Dale was a good coach or not. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. In order to be a great coach, you got to have great players. So I don't know. I'm going to leave it. I'm going to leave it there.
BJ, listen, man, thank you very much for being willing to spend some time with us during these uncertain times. We enjoyed it, and stay safe. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, you guys be good. Thank you, and stay safe as well.
Thank you, BJ. Take care.
We appreciate it. That's BJ Armstrong with us for our latest edition of Score Stories.
That was a snub, The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's been years since I saw it, but we got a lot of that last week. Where in the world is The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh? Didn't make it.
I didn't think we would get that many texts on that, but that's where we are in this era of sports talk radio. But all right, so coming up next, April Fool's Day is approaching, and no radio company is allowed to really do any April Fool's stuff. And there's a reason for this, and I believe it's because of our next guest, Opie of Opie and Anthony. We're going to get his theory on that and talk some radio with Opie next on The Score.
On April Fool's Day, WAAF DJs Opie and Anthony, who like to refer to themselves as demented, told their listeners Mayor Menino had been killed in a car accident. At the time it aired, the mayor's wife, Angela, thought her husband was in a car on the way to the airport, so she thought it was true. I caught up with the DJs outside their Westboro studios.
Yeah.
You think saying the mayor was dead was crossing the line, though?
I feel bad that the mayor's, you know, wife heard it. Who knew that the mayor's family is fans of the Opie and Anthony show?
Used to be.
Yeah. So we and every radio station now around this time gets a corporate email reminding people that, hey, April Fool's pranks, they're totally outlawed. And so we were thinking during these weird quarantine show times, as we're just telling stories and there's no sports to talk about, maybe we can get to the bottom of why that is, and to kind of paint the picture of the weird times that we are in with Sports Talk Radio, we go from BJ Armstrong to Opie of the old Opie and Anthony show. You can still listen to him. He's got his Opie Radio podcast. You get that wherever podcasts are available. He's on the Alpamonte Ford hotline. Opie, you're on in Chicago. McNeil and Parkins on The Score. Thanks so much for the time, man.
Oh, hey, guys. Thanks for having me. First of all, you just played that old clip of me, and I sound like a real jerk.
Yeah, any regrets?
I'm like a real jerk. You live long enough, you come to the realization that you can't relate to your old self anymore. But I was like such a surfer dude back there. I was just such an idiot. Do I have regrets? I actually do, yeah. I now that I'm older and hopefully wiser and I'm a father of two, I don't know if I would have done that same stunt, you know, nowadays, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, you ruined it for the rest of us, man. You guys got all the fun in back in the day with radio doing these insane pranks, and now no one's allowed to do any April Fool's Day pranks anymore.
I kind of feel bad, but radio needed to wake up at the time. I'm saying at the time. There were so many morning shows doing really hacky April Fool's pranks, and none of them were believable. And I was pacing my apartment that morning, and I'm like, what could we do today to really, you know, blow up the whole April Fool's prank? And it came into my head, let's say that the mayor of Boston died in a fiery car accident. And I'm just saying that, I'm cringing, trust me. So I call up Anthony, and Anthony's half asleep. And go, hey, this is what we're doing today. We're going to say that the mayor of Boston died in a fiery car accident for April Fool's. And Anthony goes, yeah, whatever, oh, fine, I'll see you in a couple hours. You know, he was barely awake. And then I remember, you know, we looked at each other like, are we going to do this today? Are we going to do this? And I just said, you know, F it, and announced it, and the rest is history.
Opie, my partner and I were walking to the parking garage, I don't know, a month or so ago, and we were talking about our business, whether it's AM, FM, Sirius XM, whatever the case may be, podcast. And I made the comment to him, my young radio son, I said to Danny, Howard's the only MF-er out of all of us who won. Do you feel like you won in the radio game?
I don't know if I won. I just felt it needed some adrenaline. I don't know. I mean, that is a great question, because I know a lot of things changed after that prank. And then, you know, then we go to New York and we get fired again for the whole Sex for Sam stunt that we did for 3 years in a row. And then after that, they really shut down radio because they increased the, you know, the fines, the FCC fines and whatnot. So, but I think the time was right for just to blow up the whole thing. Unfortunately, you know, it hurt a lot of people that were still in the radio game.
Yeah, I can't imagine now that you've done all of those different mediums. I can't imagine you miss terrestrial radio very much.
I mean, I'm a guest on a lot of radio shows, and I enjoy it. I mean, I think it's obviously way more challenging, but I also think that the whole shock jock game is long gone. I mean, you got to remember when me and Anthony were pulling all those stunts. It was before we all were walking around with our, you know, our heads in our phones. you know, you can't shock anybody on the radio anymore because you could see way worse on your phone. So I think there's going to be a resurgence with radio, believe it or not.
Based on what?
I can tell right now that McNeil, you're the radio vet, and you've been through a few wars, huh?
Yeah, I've been on the wrong end of a few of those letters from Human Resources. In fact, my agent recently gave me a stack of them because I'm starting to get ready to write the book. So that can cover a lot of territory right there. I've got to ask you about a 20-year relationship with Anthony,
sure.
And whether you do sports talk or general talk, salute, it's a unit of push and pull, and you spend so much time with your partner. To
yes.
What do you attribute being able to survive 20 years with two very combative, insistent, creative, probably very insecure people?
It was the money.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'm not even joking. It was the money. I mean, me and Anthony, we started out, we were pretty close. We started at BAV on Long Island, and then we got the gig in Boston. And for the first two or three years, we were close, man. We were definitely friends, and, you know, we had the type of relationship that we talked all the time, even when we weren't on the air. And then by the time we came to New York, we were on a rocket ship. I mean, the first few months in New York, we weren't doing that great because they were making us play really crappy music. And it was my idea, me and Anthony, driving home one day to Long Island and go, hey, this music is awful. So we decided to just, you know, blow up the music and just start talking. And next thing you know, the ratings ticked up a little bit and then a little more. And then it was just through the roof. And then they started syndicating us. And we pretty much stopped talking to each other off air in 2000. And we lasted another 14 years after that. But the, you know, the money was crazy, the fame was crazy, the syndication was crazy. It was just a complete runaway train.
You did a radio show with someone who you never spoke to off air for 14 years?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He would only call me if he had a problem with me. Like a real problem, you know what I mean, where he couldn't take it anymore, then he would call me.
Okay.
No, I could count. In 14 years, starting in 2000, we might have got on the phone a couple times a year, maybe. And we would try to, you know, hash out some of our problems and our issues. And then, you know, we would. And then we would think that it would go back to the old days. And then quickly it would just go back to where it was, which is just, if you think about it, it's insane because we had great chemistry when those mics were on. But as soon as we turned those mics off, we barely looked at each other and we barely talked to each other.
Let me take a shot at one of those phone calls might have been when he was not happy with you. You didn't laugh hard enough at a joke.
Not really. I mean, you know, Anthony was very funny, and you know, he's a talent. And no, I gave him more than you know. I made sure I laughed at everything that I thought was funny. So.
For a short period of time, I was a fan of the Maxwell Show when it was on the morning loop here in Chicago. Got a friend who worked on that show. I guess you guys had some wars with the Maxwell Show. What was that all about?
Honestly, at this point, I don't even know anymore. I mean, we had guys because we were kind of on the top that everyone would just start taking shots at us. And we were fighting so many battles with so many radio shows across America that I could honestly tell you, I don't know what the Maxwell problem was at the time. I know he would try to beat us up and, you know, take shots at us. But me and Anthony's philosophy back then was, you know, you take a little shot at us, we're going to take a nuclear warhead right back at you. We didn't play fairly, that's for sure.
We're talking to Opie of the old Opie and Anthony show. He's got his podcast, the Opie Radio Podcast. When I was preparing, knowing that you were coming on, I was reminded that you guys did the pregame show for the XFL back in the day.
We were handpicked by Vince McMahon to do the pregame show on NBC for the XFL. And man, were we in over our heads. Oh, God.
Yeah, so, like, how? Why? Like, I don't really have many vivid memories of that, but I cannot imagine. I know the league didn't last very long, but how did that go, and how did it fall apart?
Well, we were in very tightly with, at the time, it was WWF, and then they obviously, you know, turned it to WWE, and we had all the wrestlers on, and McMahon loved us, and they're like, yeah, we have an idea. We'll just do this crazy, ridiculous pregame show, and we'll have Opie and Anthony, host the thing. And they want us to do it live at the Hard Rock Cafe. We didn't know anything about the players, and they were forcing us to interview guys that we didn't care about, because if they were good enough, they would have been in the NFL, obviously, and we knew that. So we were trying to do our dumb bits and, you know, with girls and this and that. And so our fans would come. They would get hammered before we came on stage as they're trying to, you know, take this for NBC. And I went down to 30 Rock for an edit for the first pregame show. And the director's sitting there, like, man, how'd it go? You know, and actually, we thought we did pretty good live in front of everybody at the Hard Rock Cafe. He goes, we can't use any of this. I'm like, why? And he goes, I'll show you. So there were monitors on the side while me and Anthony were on stage. And our fans were taking their thumb and index finger and making, I got to be careful because this is regular radio. They were making believe, they were lining up their index finger and their thumb and looking at the monitor, so it's lining up with our packages, let's just say.
Yeah.
And they were minting like they were, you know, doing something to us. And it was in every shot. So they had to, like, they had to edit this thing with just terrible angle shots just to get it on the air.
Yeah, I could see that not going so well.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you something better, but it's regular radio. I don't want to get you guys.
Yeah, no, again,
regular radio. That's where we're stranded, Danny, in the world of regular radio.
Hey, man, he's right. The Opie Radio podcast, you can check it out for the uncensored version of the story. Listen, I know you're a New Yorker and you guys were huge in New York. You're out on Long Island right now, but it's kind of the epicenter of this coronavirus crisis in America. What can you tell us about what it's like in New York right now?
Sure. So I left New York 2 weeks ago, and I was just telling, you know, Chris, your producer there, that we don't see ourselves going back for a year. And I'm not even joking. I have two small kids. Their schools are pretty much shut down. They're going to be doing some of that online learning, which, you know, a lot of us are going to be doing with our kids. But about 2.5 weeks ago, they were still in school. And when that first case came out in Washington State, where they said the person had no contact with anybody from China, and they couldn't figure out how this person got the coronavirus, I looked at my wife and said, this virus has been in America way longer than they're telling us. And then the fear and the anxiety, you know, kicked in with me. And we made it to, like I said, about 2 weeks ago. And we packed up the car, and I'm lucky enough to, you know, have another house way out east on Long Island, and we just bailed. We just bailed out of the city. It is terrible there. The fear in New York City 2 weeks ago was really bad, and I can't even imagine how it is right now. So, yeah,
that's
where we're at, unfortunately. Yeah, how are you guys doing with this thing?
I mean, we were the second state to do the mandatory, you know, stay-at-home shutdown. The grade that Chicago and Illinois have been graded on for staying in place, apparently we're doing a good job at flattening the curve. But
yeah,
who the hell knows? You know what I mean? There's so many people here, and it's an international city just like New York is. So it seems like New York and the Bay Area are a little bit ahead of us, but there is still concern of medical overrun and all of that. So all of us are broadcasting from home if we can. And, you know, we're just kind of waiting and seeing. The idea of not going back for a full year is fairly terrifying. I don't think most people around here are there yet. But one of my best friends lives right in New York City, and he's painting a very similar picture as you are.
Yeah, I mean, the picture's coming out of New York. I'm from Long Island originally, but I live in New York City since 9/11. And to see Times Square with nobody there is just, I don't even think it was like that after 9/11 the first few days. It's just incredible. What's the fear in your heads when you leave your house? Like, I'm to the point where we don't even leave our house without a mask and gloves. And some people look at that as, like, that's ridiculous. But I just see, you know, people, and you just simply don't know who has this thing and who doesn't. And fair enough, you know, we can easily have it because we were, you know, in New York when this thing was first growing.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I have a newborn son who was born prematurely, and so he could be immunocompromised. So trust me, man, like, my anxiety is through the roof. I'm not taking masks because they, at least in this country, they're saying, you know, those masks need to go to the medical professionals, and they're not going to do anything for you if you're healthy, and they're not necessarily going to prevent you from getting it. I know people in Asian countries disagree with that. There's the jury's out on that, I guess, in some circles. But, yeah, concern. Yeah. Concern is the best way to describe it.
Oh, and I should explain before people get mad at me. I don't have an official mask. I'm making my own.
Oh, okay. I was going to tell, you know, good luck finding one if you wanted to try to buy one, even if they, you know, if you did feel they would help. And if I could find one, I'd be wearing one. I don't care what people say. To me, you can't be safe enough.
Usually it's just wrapping towels around my face, but everyone is doing, you know, all of that stuff. And then have you guys had packages delivered to your house? And how does that feel?
I mean, yes, I have. But what are you going to do? Like,
I'm embarrassed to tell you. I put on my gloves. Uh-huh. I get all sorts of disinfected, and I'm spraying boxes. And everyone thought I was nuts, but then it came out today that there's 8 Amazon workers that tested positive for the coronavirus, and they say that the virus does live on the cardboard for a few days. So basically, I spray the boxes down, and you guys need to know something about me. Like, and you know, through my radio career, I've done really crazy stuff. I'm not a germaphobe by any stretch of the imagination, even though my last name is Hughes, as in Howard Hughes. But for some reason with this thing, I'm overly paranoid. So I'll spray down the boxes. Then I'll open up the boxes. What's ever in there, I'll spray those down. And then we're putting you know, the items in another room for a couple days. That's how nuts I've gotten over this thing.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I know that sounds ridiculous. Trust me, I know how it sounds.
Yeah. I mean, better to be safe than sorry. So I can't totally judge it. I'm the only one leaving the house here. I'm, you know, doing curbside grocery pickup and then coming right back. You know, but at some point, it's like if you're going to get it, you're going to get it, right? I don't know if I would be disinfecting cardboard, but hey, there you go.
Well, I don't know how old you guys are. I know Dan McNeil. You've been around a little longer, but did you ever go to a chicken pox party when you were growing up?
No, I'm 33. Yeah, I've never heard of such a thing.
I don't remember having a party for chicken pox. I had awful chicken pox. But...
Well, I'm older than you guys. So when I was growing up, you know, our parents wanted to get the chicken pox over with. Trust me, you throw this out to your listeners, they're going to go, yes, I'm one of those people too. And so you would find out who had chickenpox in the neighborhood, and your parents would send you over there for a play date to get the chickenpox. And then in my case, I have, like, it depends, 6, 7, 8, you know, kids in my family. Then, one of us comes home with the chickenpox and gives it to the rest of the family so we could get it out of the way.
Huh.
That's how we grew up.
Maybe that's Long Island.
No, I'm telling you. I will make a bet with you. You go to your phone, someone's going to go, yup, that happened to me. So my thought is, I wonder if we should have coronavirus parties and just get it over with if we're all going to get it.
We had a director of infectious disease on from a hospital earlier, so he had his suggestions, and then you have your coronavirus party suggestions. I just don't know who to trust here.
No, I don't want to get this. It's more of a whatever, but I don't know. Going back to the April Fool's prank, I do have to say, so you fast forward, that happened in 98. You fast forward to around 20, I'm trying to remember, but 20, call it like 17-ish. Mayor Menino came through SiriusXM. He was promoting a book, and I tried everything to get him on my show. I was doing a solo show at this point because I wanted to apologize to the guy. And all those years later, he said no. He said no. He didn't want anything to do with it.
Got to be honest, I kind of understand.
Yeah, you wouldn't accept an apology?
No, I would listen. I'm a radio guy. I understand what you were doing. But from his standpoint, if he gets a frantic call from his wife thinking it was dead, like I could, you know, I've held a grudge in my life too. Is all I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, at the time, I didn't think anyone was going to believe it either.
Yeah, well, power of the microphone. Opie, listen, man, we appreciated you trading some war stories with us. Good luck with the podcast, and hopefully you could go back to New York in less than a year, man. Thank you very much for the time.
Thanks, Opie.
All right, guys. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We'll see you. You bet.
That's Opie of the old Opie and Anthony show. You can check out his Opie Radio podcast wherever podcasts are available.
20 years of partnership, the last 14 of them, no contact off the air. When the red light goes on, I know you. When we're out of segment, I don't know you. What an existence. Mike and the Mad Dog had a similar one, but not nearly as long as that one was.
Yeah, that's fairly remarkable. Obviously, a very famous radio pairing breakup. I think people would be interested in us taking them behind the scenes of that conversation, Mac, about the idea of nobody winning in radio. And I don't know if you're up for it in these
odds. Oh, sure. Perfect timing.
All right. Yeah, fair enough. We can maybe text.
6 days from expiration date.
All right, we can text about it off air if you'd like.
All right.
I got baseball stuff for you as well, so we'll see where we go next on the score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.